Sponsorship of the KQED live audio stream comes from Stanford Continuing Studies. This winter, join Professor Alexander Nemirov for Outlandish Life, Peter Paul Rubens and the Baroque, exploring the dramatic art of the 17th century. Learn more at continuingstudies.stanford.edu.
From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Grace Wan, in for Alexis Madrigal. The brave new world we're living in is constantly dangling new technology before us. Robots in the office, cars that can fly, and now, designer babies. According to a Wall Street Journal investigation, a handful of Bay Area startups are focused on modifying human embryos to make babies who are not just free of disease, but who also have higher IQs, among other traits. We'll talk about the science and ethics of genetic engineering. That's all coming up next, right after this news.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The Trump administration is standing by its campaign of targeting and killing the crews of small boats accused of smuggling drugs from South America to the United States. However, questions are mounting about the legality of those strikes, and critics say they believe a war crime was committed in at least one such encounter on September 2nd. It's still unclear who exactly gave each order to use deadly force, even though Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth has been visibly at the forefront of the overall campaign. NPR's Deirdre Walsh reports on Hegseth's account during President Trump's cabinet meeting yesterday about the September 2nd deadly strikes in the Caribbean.
He said he gave the initial order to strike the boat and then said he learned the details about the second strike a couple of hours later and said it was a decision made by Admiral Frank Bradley, who leads U.S. Special Operations Command. While Hegseth stressed he personally didn't make the call for a follow-on strike, he said Bradley had the complete authority to do so.
NPR's Deirdre Walsh. The Kremlin says some aspects of the latest U.S. proposal for ending the war in Ukraine are unacceptable, but Russia remains open to further talks. This follows 5 hours of high-level discussions in Moscow yesterday involving Russian President Vladimir Putin, President Trump's special envoy Steve Witkoff, and Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner. Here's NPR's Charles Maines.
Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov rejected the idea Russia had dismissed the U.S. peace plan outright, saying Putin's give and take over U.S. proposals was a normal part of the negotiating process. Peskov said Moscow remained open to future meetings to narrow differences, but that Russia preferred diplomacy out of the public eye. The comments came after a late-night marathon meeting between Putin and White House envoys Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner at the Kremlin failed to reach a compromise. The Americans had sought Putin's support for a revised U.S. peace plan for Ukraine, one that included more input from Ukraine and Europe after an earlier draft was criticized as heavily weighted in Russia's favor. Charles Maines, NPR News, Moscow.
Republican Matt Van Epps is the winner of a special election for a U.S. House seat in Tennessee. The race drew millions of dollars in outside spending and national attention as well. NPR's Stephen Fowle reports Democrats are also claiming a victory of sorts.
President Trump won Tennessee's 7th congressional district last November by about 22 percentage points. This week, Matt Van Epps won by 9. After super PACs from both parties poured millions of dollars into this high-profile contest, Democrats say the 13-point overperformance by their candidate Afton Bain is a good sign for 2026. In 60 state legislative and congressional special elections this year, Democrats have improved from their 2024 margins by an average of 13%. Stephen Fowler, NPR News.
At last check on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was up 221 points. This is NPR News.
Live from KQED News, I'm Brian Watt. San Francisco's Board of Supervisors has approved the mayor's family zoning plan, which allows for taller and denser construction, particularly in residential neighborhoods on the west and north sides of the city. The plan, approved in a 7-4 vote at yesterday's board meeting, aims to create capacity for 36,000 new units to meet state housing requirements. Supervisor Myrna Melgar was among those who voted yes.
Rezoning itself will not solve our housing crisis or our affordability crisis, but it is an absolutely necessary step towards meeting our compliance with the state and meeting our obligations for our economic development and our tomorrows.
Buildings with three or more rent-controlled units are exempt from demolitions under the plan after an amendment from Melgar was incorporated. A new police chief has been appointed in Richmond. City officials yesterday announced that Assistant Chief Timothy Simmons is set to take over in mid-January. Simmons has served the department for the past 17 years, starting as a beat officer and working his way up. He's also held positions in city police unions and helped lead community safety initiatives. Simmons takes over from Chief Bisa French, who's held the role since 2020 and announced in September she planned to retire. In sports, the Warriors, just like every other NBA team these days, lost to the Oklahoma City Thunder last night, 124-112. The Thunder have only lost one game this season. The Sharks host the Capitals this evening. I'm Brian Watt, KQED News.
Support comes from Postman, offering a platform to assist team build APIs to help API agents make decisions. Postman.com. Support for NPR comes from Arm. On the latest episode of Tech Unheard, Arm CEO and host Rene Haas talks to Jayshree Ullal, CEO of cloud networking company Arista Networks, about how tech and AI are helping to shape the future of computing. And by the listeners and members of KQED.
Welcome to Forum. I'm Grace Wan, in for Alexis Madrigal. 7 years ago, a Chinese scientist, He Zhongkui, announced that he had helped produce genetically engineered babies, eliminating HIV from their embryos. He did not win the Nobel Prize. Instead, he went to jail. In the U.S. and in many other countries, it's illegal to modify a human embryo with the intention of giving birth to a baby. But according to a Wall Street Journal investigation, that has not stopped a handful of Bay Area startups from trying to genetically engineer embryos. Joining us to talk about the science and the ethics of these endeavors, we're joined by Dr. Fedor Ernov, professor of molecular therapeutics at UC Berkeley and a scientific director at its Innovative Genomics Institute. Welcome to Forum, Dr. Ernov.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
We also have Katie Hassan. She's the executive director at the Center for Genetics and Society. Welcome, Katie.
Welcome. Good morning.
And we have Catherine Long, a reporter on the investigations team at the Wall Street Journal. She co-wrote the piece, Genetically Engineered Babies Are Banned. Tech titans are trying to make one anyway. Welcome, Catherine.
So happy to be here. Thanks.
Well, Catherine, I wanted to start with you. Your piece looks at the work of a handful of Bay Area startups, one of which is called Preventive. Who is behind that company and what is it trying to accomplish?
So our reporting found that about 6 or 7 months ago, a company called Preventive incorporated in downtown San Francisco, WeWork, and it's aiming to tackle a problem that has terrified and exhilarated scientists in equal measure for decades, and that is editing embryos to create a genetically engineered baby. Our reporting found that it's backed by Sam Altman's family office and Coinbase co-founder Brian Armstrong. In private, executives of the company have said that they've identified a couple with a genetic disease who's interested in participating. Now, the company's founder, Lucas Harrington, has said that's inaccurate and that the company is not going to bring a baby to term until they've done enough preclinical research to show that the technology is safe.
Is the desire of Preventive to create a genetically engineered baby that's free of disease, or are there other aspects to the creation of this child that they're interested in?
Preventive has said that it's solely focused on preventing hereditary disease. And in a blog post on his personal website last year, Preventive's founder, Harrington, has brought up the example of sickle cell disease and said that he believes that embryo editing could one day be as low priced as maybe $2,000 or $5,000 per cycle.
Yeah. I mean, the practice of editing human embryos to create a baby, as we've talked about, is illegal in the U.S. How is Preventive getting around that?
Our reporting shows that Preventive is exploring other jurisdictions in which to conduct this research, possibly the United Arab Emirates, where embryo editing is legal.
And how would that work exactly? They would do all the research in a foreign country, but have clients in the United States. Walk us through that.
That's a great question. And it's something that our reporting wasn't able to uncover. But that's something that we are interested in continuing to follow.
Well, we should note that we invited Preventive to join our program, but they declined. And Dr. Urnov, I want to turn to you. You've been on the leading edge of this field of human genome editing in embryos, humans. I mean, is it scientifically feasible to edit an embryo in the way that Preventive is talking about?
Unfortunately, it is.
And how does that work?
Well, Jennifer Doudna, professor at UC Berkeley here, won the Nobel Prize for inventing a method of gene editing. A layperson term is called CRISPR. The technology is well understood. It has been used clinically over the past 7 years. There is an approved medicine to treat sickle cell disease in existing human beings, adolescents and adults with sickle. It's been in clinical trials where it's been used to treat many hundreds of people. So step one, if you want to make a CRISPR to fix a mutation in a human cell, whether it's inside an adult or a child or in a human embryo, we know how to do that. In the case of an adult of our child, so an existing person with an existing disease, you have various ways of getting the CRISPR into the body. You can literally inject it intravenously, or you can take some cells out, fix them, and put them back in. Now, when you do embryo editing, it's really very different. You, first of all, rely on established technologies of in vitro fertilization. We all know about Louise Brown. This is a really well-established field. You use in vitro fertilization to generate a human embryo, which does not look at all like a human, let's be clear. It's a very small, beautiful little thing, but it's not yet a human baby. And then you inject CRISPR directly into it. And then you hold your breath, close your eyes, hide behind closed doors, in the hope that CRISPR inside that embryo will do its thing, which is, let's say, fix the mutation. And then presumably, again, assuming the world will let you do that, which I hope it doesn't, that embryo gets delivered to mom, and presumably mom then gives birth to this improved baby. As you can tell from the hesitance in my voice, this is absolutely beyond the pale, ethically and clinically. And so for me to speak with you and say this is scientifically feasible, I want to be clear. I say this with absolutely zero joy and 100% dread.
Well, tell me a little bit about the dread that is attached to that for you. You know, these companies are saying that they can eliminate disease. That seems like a good thing. So where's the dread come in?
I'm really glad you asked. I was thinking of an analogy, and here's what I was able to come up with. Let's think of writing poetry. Imagine you wanted a poem about hope. And so you would take Emily Dickinson, and she would write that famous poem, Hope is That Thing with Feathers, etc. Or separately, you could turn to ChatGPT, or let's say Gemini 3, and say, ChatGPT, write me a poem about hope. We all understand that the back end, like what is physically involved in a human being writing poetry, like one person, or this extraordinary technological advance of AI, which is giant server farms, thousands of computer scientists, et cetera, they're just completely different things. And in this case, it matters. We have known that humans have genetic diseases since the 1900s. We first understood the molecular basis of disease, such disease, and starting with sickle in 1950. In 1972, scientists at UCSD said, you know what, let's use DNA to fix genetic diseases. That was first tried in 1989. It first worked in 1996. And then, lo and behold, 2012, Jennifer Doudna and Manuel Chapatier unveiled CRISPR, and now we have clinical trials. What we have now learned, and this is going back to human poets versus, you know, AI writing poetry, is we can take an existing child or an existing adult. And I'll give you two specific examples. For the child, you have reported, and Catherine has reported, that there is a human being. His name is Kyle Muldoon Jr. He lives in Clifton Heights, Pennsylvania, with his mom, Nicole, and his dad, Kyle Sr. And in February 25, 2025, he received a personal CRISPR. He was injected with that CRISPR by his treating physician, Rebecca Ahrens-Nicholas, and that CRISPR went to his liver, fixed the disease, and he's back home. In terms of adult disease, sickle cell disease, there's a brave human named Victoria Gray. She suffered horribly with sickle cell disease. Her stem cells were taken out of her body, treated with CRISPR, put back in. She's back to leading a fruitful, productive life free of symptoms. We know how to do that for both pediatric and adult disease. Now imagine a couple who are at genetic risk of having a child with a genetic disease. What do you do? Well, maybe let's just edit the baby. No. For a large number of years now, there have been two very well-established, safe, effective, extraordinarily powerful, widely available technologies to prevent that couple's child from having a child with a disease. The first one is called carrier screening. This is where the prospective couple have their DNA analyzed, and if they're both carriers for a variant of a gene that could cause disease, then they get genetic counseling and make informed choices about reproduction. I encourage your audience to read a wonderful article in the New York Times about how successful this is. This came out maybe 10 years ago, and the title is really striking. Quote, "Using genetic testing, Ashkenazi Jews vanquish a genetic disease." And it describes a spectacularly successful public health effort where a specific community that for historic reasons has a higher chance of having children with particular genetic diseases. To be very clear, this is like the 90s. This is way before CRISPR. The other option, and I'm wrapping up here, is you can use in vitro fertilization, right? So sperm, egg, hello, embryo. But instead of editing it, you can just pick one that doesn't have the disease. I teach genetics. It's called Gregor Mendel. Remember the guy with peas, yellow flowers, whatever?
Mm-hmm.
A couple, each one of whom carries the disease gene allele, has a 1 in 4 chance of having a baby with a disease. Fine. Fertilize 4 embryos, pick one without the mutation, implant that. Thank you for letting me explain this. I'm really grateful that we're shining a light on this. There are safe and effective approaches to both preventing genetic disease and treating it. None of them involves editing an embryo.
Well, we are talking about these companies saying, okay, we're going to try to prevent disease. But Catherine, in your piece, you note it's not just diseases they're trying to prevent. It's sort of traits that they're also trying to bring forth in embryonic form. What are some of the traits that people are talking about as things that they can show you your baby might have?
Sure. Well, in our article, we describe two types of companies, embryo editing companies and polygenic screening companies. And polygenic screening is a type of this pre-implantation testing that Dr. Ernov was referring to in his previous comment, this testing that can determine whether an embryo may or may not be a carrier of a specific disease. So returning first to embryo editing companies, right? Preventive, we've established, has said that it is focused on disease. That being said, one of the investors in Preventive, Coinbase co-founder Brian Armstrong, has said in private that he imagines a future where IVF clinics employ what he calls a, quote, Gattaca stack of technologies to optimize human development. And he said that he looks forward to potentially trying to ensure that humans have greater bone density, for instance. That's one of the optimizations that he's referenced. Now, turning to the polygenic screening companies, these are a different group of companies. These are companies such as Nucleus Genomics, Orchid Health, and Heracyte. Some of these companies have unveiled tests that they say can give some insight into an embryo's future IQ, height, or even eye color.
Wow. Well, we're talking about efforts to create a genetically engineered baby by modifying its embryo. I mean, what could go wrong? We're joined by Dr. Fedor Ernov, Katie Hassan, and Catherine Long. More on this after the break. I'm Grace Wan, in for Alexis Madrigal. Stay tuned.
Support for KQED comes from San Francisco's Meta Fund, advancing health and equity in aging, and reminding listeners that elders add value to communities every day. Learn more at mettafund.org. Xfinity, delivering smart Wi-Fi, mobile, home security, and entertainment to help power a seamlessly connected life. Learn more at Xfinity.com. Xfinity, imagine that.
Hackers are using AI to target corporations, governments, and maybe even you. What can you do about it? Find out next time in Here and Now.
Starting at 11. Thanks to your incredible response yesterday, our Giving Newsday match has been extended with $20,000 more on the line. Help KQED turn up the volume and double your donation before midnight tonight at kqed.org/donate.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Grace Wan, in for Alexis Madrigal. Today we're talking about efforts to create a genetically engineered baby by modifying its embryo. And we're joined by Dr. Fedor Ernov. He's a professor of molecular therapeutics at UC Berkeley and a scientific director at its Innovative Genomics Institute. We have Katie Hassan. She's the executive director of the Center for Genetics and Society. And also Catherine Long, a reporter on the investigations team at the Wall Street Journal. She co-wrote the piece, Genetically Engineered Babies Are Banned. And tech titans are trying to make one anyway. We'd love to hear from you, listeners, about what you're hearing, what you're thinking about what you're hearing. What are your concerns about genetically engineering an embryo? Do you favor screening embryos for diseases? How about for traits like eye color or IQ? And do you work in this industry? Are you a genetic counselor? Are you involved in genetic editing? Tell us what you are seeing in your industry and what you think about it. Give us a call now at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can email your comments and questions to forum@kqed.org, or you can find us on social media, Blue Sky, Instagram, or at KQED Forum, or join our Discord community. Catherine, I wanted to return back to you because right before the break, we were talking about the idea of polygenic screening, which I think you described as screening these embryos for certain types of diseases, certain types of traits. And it sounds a little bit like a brave new world in the approach that these companies are taking. Tell me a little bit about what they claim to offer that doesn't already exist in the world of genetic counseling.
Sure. Well, embryo screening has been around for a very long time. You know, we've been screening embryos for diseases like Tay-Sachs. We've been screening embryos for sex for a number of years now. These polygenic screening companies are seeking to account for the influence of dozens or hundreds of genes on a trait or on a disease. And they're coming up with probabilities that once an embryo becomes a child, that child or eventually an adult will develop those diseases or possess those traits. It's sort of a nascent science, and people involved in the field have expressed a great deal of skepticism about whether it's going to work, whether these predictions are going to play out.
Well, Katie Hassan, you're the executive director of the Center for Genetics and Society, and you know, you all take an ethical view of what's going on in the world of genetics. I mean, as you hear these new technologies or these new approaches to technology in terms of polygenic screening or editing of embryos, what is your reaction?
Well, I think, you know, one thing that we need to bring into the discussion is to really talk about eugenics and how these technologies relate to it. I mean, people associate eugenics, you know, with the Nazis and the atrocities of the Holocaust. And that narrative, eugenics, disappeared after World War II. But eugenics was a thriving movement in the U.S. long before. And we know about the ways that, you know, thousands of people, primarily people of color with disabilities, were sterilized under eugenic sterilization laws in the U.S. But at the same time that that was happening, there was another side, the so-called positive eugenics or soft eugenics, which was really about improving the population by encouraging people with desirable characteristics to have more children, right? The idea that we can control reproduction in order to improve society. And both strands of that have continued, but I think this idea that we should try to have better or perfect babies is what we see carrying over into this new techno-eugenics.
You know, and Katie, what comes to mind for me is the kind of metaphysical question, like, what is a better baby? What is a perfect baby? I mean, in terms of ethics, I mean, is there such a thing?
That's a great question. I think it raises the question of, you know, especially when we're talking about these Silicon Valley startups that are offering these technologies, you know, who is making these decisions or whose visions of a better or a perfect baby are driving these products that are then shaping the choices that prospective parents have when they go to form their families, right? Are those the values and the visions of the future that we really all support? I would say no.
Mm-hmm. Well, Noelle on Discord writes, didn't the leaders of these companies see the science fiction film Gattaca? And Catherine, I want to take that to you because you mentioned that some of the founders of these companies have created something called a Gattaca stack, which is a reference to this 1997 movie, and it depicts a dystopian eugenic future. They seem excited about having a world of Gattaca. And I remember seeing the film with a beautiful Ethan Hawke and Uma Thurman, and it seemed to be anti-eugenics.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I assume that Brian Armstrong, who posted on X about wanting to create a Gattaca stack of technologies, has seen Gattaca. I don't believe we asked him about his opinion of the movie. I'd be at a loss, unfortunately, to opine about their interpretation of the morals of that story.
Well, and going back to you, Katie, I mean, it is an anti-eugenics movie. So, I mean, is there some irony for you that this is an aspiration, not something to avoid?
Absolutely. That's actually exactly what I was going to say. It's really striking that these tech titans seem to see Gattaca as an aspiration. And, you know, it really is a vision of kind of genetically engineered humanity produced at sort of industrial scale. I mean, this Gattaca stack that Armstrong has described involves, you know, joining together a series of these technologies, right? The not just polygenic embryo screening and embryo editing, but also the creation of eggs and sperm in the lab and the use of artificial wombs, right? Bringing those all together in order to, in some way, he said, accelerate evolution and improve humanity according to their vision.
Wow. Let's go to the phones. Stephen from Dublin, welcome to Forum.
Hi, thank you.
What's your question?
Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can hear you just fine. What's your question about this?
We have an egg donor surrogate child who's on the spectrum. Now, I would never change that, but how do you screen embryos for genetic defects, and do women who freeze their eggs also have this option?
That's a really good question. Dr. Ernov, let me take that to you.
I want to be careful to not turn Forum into Genetics 101.
Well, if anybody could explain it, I think it is you. So.
So reading the DNA of an embryo is technically trivial. I can't believe I'm saying this, but here we go. The 64,000 DNA base pair question is, what do you do next? You can do one of two things. You can scan the DNA for one of 6,000 known places where you can have a genetic defect that by itself will cause disease. Sickle cell disease, hemophilia, cystic fibrosis. You can do that to an embryo and you can say, ah, you embryo are not the droid we're looking for. We're not going to implant you. We're going to implant the adjacent embryo in the same dish that doesn't have the bad form of the gene. But sir, the deeper question you're raising is what happens to more complex traits? You know, you mentioned a child with on the spectrum in your turn of phrase. And here I really want to draw the audience's attention and yours. My older daughter, who appeared naturally without any sequencing or embryo editing, she lives in Manhattan as a book editor. There's a company called, I forget what it's called. I think something like Nucleus IVF or whatever.
They Nucleus Genomics, yes.
Oh, is that right? Yeah. So yes. They have these ads, which cause me to faint. It basically has a beautiful baby and it says, have your best baby. So what are they talking about? They're talking about something that would make my students fall asleep, and I don't want to do that to the audience. In brief, it is feasible to read all of the DNA of an embryo and look at hundreds and hundreds of different places in the DNA that together contribute to a trait. The best example I can give you is height. There are about 200 places in our DNA that together add up to how tall an average person is. The other good example is cardiovascular disease. Scientists have discovered a number of different places that together add up to a high risk of heart cardiovascular disease. So it breaks my heart to say, yes, You can today take an embryo, read its DNA, and pick an embryo where all of these many little genetic variants add up to potentially a taller baby or potentially a baby with less risk of cardiovascular disease. That technology exists. The science is real. The problem, and this is where I'm so grateful to Catherine for her beautiful reporting and very much want to raise this, the evil specter of eugenics, is the technologists who are supporting all of this do not understand that once you reach any other trait, mental health, for example, for mental health, let's say schizophrenia, these so-called polygenic risk scores, they just don't work. Period, end of paragraph. Pretty much for the majority of other traits, quote unquote, that these baby screeners care about, we can't really do the analysis that is being proposed. So their quasi-eugenics quest is actually doomed to fail, whether the ads are pretty or not. Now, to be clear, the science might change, and when it does, let's have this conversation again. But with the notable exception of things like height and cardiovascular disease risk, these score predictors, you know, have your best baby, whatever that means, they're lying to you.
Well, Matthew writes, I'm deeply troubled by the probability that Sam Altman and his ilk will create this new industry to create a race of Ubermensch. What do guests think about the astronomical costs associated with sending embryos to the UAE for upcycling and the possibility of a new genetically modified race of overlords? I doubt that any of this will be covered by Obamacare, so most of us will be left without these options. I mean, Katie, you know, all joking aside, this is technology that is extremely expensive at this moment to the extent that anybody wants to take advantage of it. And so in that way, there's some deep inequities in this approach.
It's true that, you know, these technologies are very expensive. And, you know, at the beginning, if any of these were to become widely used, it would only be available to those who could afford it. But I don't think that's the biggest risk in terms of inequality. I think actually, you know, it's not that we should be worried about, a super race of wealthy elites, but although that is the vision that some of them have, right, turning the current economic elites into a future biological elite. But I think the bigger risk to inequality is the premise of this, which is that there are people who are genetically superior to others and that you could achieve that through intervening in the genes. That idea has been at the basis of eugenics and a number of other systems that we've seen cause real harm in society, like throughout history.
Yeah. Well, let's go to Eileen in San Rafael. Eileen, welcome to Forum.
Hi, thank you. pardon me. I just wanted to mention to the scientist, I'm sorry, I forget his name in the room, that was talking about genetic predisposition. But I'm a parent of a child with a very rare genetic disorder called Smith-Magenis syndrome, which presents on 17.11.2 and has a lot of multiple issues associated with that rare genetic disorder. And it's a spontaneous mutation. So if I were to be told what happens during this disease progress, while my daughter was still in utero, I definitely would have opted for her not to go through all of the pain and suffering that she's been through, that, you know, self-injurious behaviors, ASD, VSD, open heart surgery at 6 weeks old. You know, the list goes on and on, tonic colonic seizures, dysphagia, choking on food, multiple issues. And I don't see what would be ethically wrong with me making a decision on a random mutation while my daughter was in utero to save her from that. We should also address in the room, which is when you have these rare genetic disorders and the parents that are dealing with them, there is a huge loss of income. There's a huge loss of, you know, just regular, you know, life as we
Eileen, I think we lost you, but thank you so much for sharing your story and that of your daughter. I mean, Dr. Ernov, you do address, and I think you've said your inbox is filled with parents of children who have rare genetic diseases, some which you are able to address and some which you are not. What do you make of Eileen's comment about living with a rare genetic disease and watching your child, I think, suffer through that?
Eileen, first, thank you for sharing your story. It is brave of you, and my heart sincerely goes out to you. I received this morning an email from a parent of a child who is losing their vision. As somebody who works with families living with genetic diseases of children full time, the sense of urgency in terms of getting help to these families is enormous, and that drives everything we do. Let's actually, if you allow, since you are courageously sharing your story, which is deeply heartfelt and deeply moving, let's talk through this. First, I completely agree with you. In a number of settings, we cannot read the parent's DNA and say you will not have a baby with a genetic disease, because some of these mutations just appear spontaneously, and we even know why. So what does that mean? Well, it means that carrier screening is not 100%, and your moving story attests to that. Number two, in many cases, for example, for a neurodevelopmental disease, such as I understand your child is living with, we kind of have to intervene super early in order to make sure that we prevent the genetic damage from causing damage to the baby. But then number three, looking ahead to a few years when these technologies for CRISPR in adults and children are widely available, first things first. Scientists and physicians at UCSF, and I want to mention a leading physician in this regard, Dr. Tippi McKenzie, are actively working on doing precisely what you're advocating for, which is in utero editing of an existing fetus or a child. And what that would involve, and again, I'm basically channeling Tippi McKenzie, you diagnose early in the pregnancy that this is a child being carried with a genetic defect, and you manufacture a gene editor on demand for that child, and then you deliver it safely to the fetus via a surgical procedure. That will happen. It will take some time. I'm sorry to say this will not happen in the next 3 to 4 years, but in the next 7 to 8 years, this will be reality. What I'm really mindful of, however, is this concept of doing this to an embryo, right? So consider a setting where you have chosen in vitro fertilization, and there are 8 embryos in a dish in the doctor's clinic, and you read one of the embryos, oh, wow, it has this new mutation. So what do you do? Do you implant that embryo? Do you read the DNA of an adjacent embryo? So bottom line, we are working all out to develop medicines for living children with genetic diseases. Some are really harder than others. I hate to say this to you. Neurodevelopmental conditions are tougher than, for example, blood disease or metabolic disease. Our goal, wrapping this up, is to get CRISPR editing to as many children and adults as we can, to as many diseases as possible, then safely advance that to editing in utero, where early stage diagnosis allows us to do precisely what I described earlier. But I continue to be really apprehensive about the notion that we should be doing this at the embryo stage before implantation, when you could potentially select an embryo that doesn't have the mutation. But let me wrap up by saying I don't want to come across as a cold-hearted scientist sitting in the ivory tower of academia. I really share your grief. I really, really do.
Well, we're talking about the efforts to create a genetically engineered baby, to screen for genetic diseases, and what Silicon Valley is doing in this regard. We're talking with Katie Hassan. She's executive director of the Center for Genetics and Society. Catherine Long, a reporter with the Wall Street Journal who's written about this. And Dr. Fyodor Ernov, professor of molecular therapeutics at UC Berkeley and a scientific director at its IGI. And we want to hear from you. Please share your concerns about what genetically engineered embryos might do for our world. You can give us a call, 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Email your comments or questions to forum@kqed.org. I'm Grace Wan, in for Alexis Madrigal. More Forum after this break. Coming up in the next hour of Forum with Mina Kim. The wind. Journalist and author Simon Winchester says that the wind is, quote, a universal. It lifts seeds and supports birds and insects. It warms and it chills. It builds and creates. It ruins and destroys. From a vibrating oboe reed to the fury of a hurricane, we talked to Winchester about how wind has shaped our culture, our history, and our planet, and how wind might be changing in response to climate change. The book is The Breath of Gods. To listen to past Forum shows, go to Spotify or Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. Just search KQED Forum. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Grace Wan, in for Alexis Madrigal, and we are talking about the efforts to create a genetically engineered baby by modifying its embryos, or also screening embryos for traits, diseases, and making sure that Silicon Valley wants us to have better babies. We're talking with Katie Hassan. She's the executive director of the Center for Genetics and Society, Catherine Long, a reporter with the Wall Street Journal who has been covering this issue, and Dr. Fyodor Urnov, professor of molecular therapeutics at UC Berkeley, and a specialist on gene editing. And we're taking your calls and questions about genetically engineering embryos, whether you favor this or not, and maybe perhaps you work in the field of genetics. What are you hearing? What is your industry doing right now? Give us a call, 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can email us at forum@kqed.org and find us on socials. We're at KQED Forum. Let's go back to the phones. Joanna in Mill Valley, welcome to Forum.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call. I want to say first, I so appreciate the perspectives of the experts on the panel, so the other callers, and especially the parents who have called in and shared, you know, such a wide spectrum of experience. I'm a physician, and I are both physicians, of a three-year-old girl who has mild sensory neural hearing loss, which was a total surprise at birth. And she wears hearing aids and has done absolutely fantastically well with us and has just thrived beyond our imagining. And I think my question to the panel is from an ethics perspective and from a practical kind of clinical counseling standpoint, I wonder, this is obviously an area that has such a slippery slope. You could gene edit, you know, for things that are purely kind of aesthetic, gene edit for all kinds of different disease states. And there's such a spectrum of different kinds of diseases that you can imagine doing gene editing for. And, you know, I think in our case, right, if you'd given us an array of embryos when I was pregnant and said, you know, this one has hearing loss, we probably would have selected a different embryo. And that, like, breaks my heart to think about that, because, you know, we wouldn't trade our daughter for anything in the entire world, and in fact have decided if we have another kid that we would not do prenatal genetic diagnosis to avoid this, even though we know there's a 25% chance that it could happen again. And I think, you know, we've learned and grown so much from watching her thrive through this and also learning about the deaf and hard of hearing community. And I just wonder, you know, is there really any way for people to know, you know, where to draw the line when they're thinking about this, right? Like, if you told me my child was going to have a painful degenerative disease, like, I probably would make a different decision, you know, than if they were going to have mild hearing loss. But I have the benefit of lived experience with my daughter, and most people don't have that. And so I guess what I'm wondering is, you know, how would you imagine counseling people about where to draw this line on the slippery slope? Is it even possible to draw a line on the slippery slope?
It's such a good question, Joanna. And Katie, I want to bring that to you. I mean, what do you think about what Joanna said?
Yeah, there are so many great points in that question. And I think that, you know, really, we do need to think about this kind of slippery slope that's happening, and the fact that, you know, when you talk about counseling prospective parents, part of the question is what information are parents getting, you know, and are they being offered sort of comprehensive information that includes the experiences of people who are living with a particular condition or who are raising a child with a particular condition? Because, you know, for a lot of people, our ideas about what disabled life will be like are shaped by sort of fears and a lack of knowledge. And it doesn't include the perspectives of people with disabilities or living with diseases who, you know, don't want to be cured or who are happy and flourishing, right? So, you know, as Joanna said, there's really a wide range of conditions that we could be talking about and experiences. And I think that we do need to think about, you know, how people make those decisions and what kind of information they are given when they do so.
Yeah. Let's go to another call. Sarah in the Central Valley, welcome to Forum.
Yes, hi. I just wanted to give a first-person perspective. So when I was pregnant with my youngest child, some tests were ran, and there were some abnormalities detected, and I was strongly encouraged to abort her. And, in fact, to the point that I was getting a call, I remember one particular where the woman told me I was being selfish and that my child would never have a quality of life and all this really horrible things that left me distraught. I did not choose to abort her. Someone, thank God, you know, was encouraged to look at my test again, and it turned out it was a problem with the test.
Wow.
And my child is healthy and happy and getting married and a college graduate and, you know, just a wonderful kid. And every time I look at her, I think about, you know, if I'd given in, to that pressure.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yep. Can I make a quick comment on that?
Yeah, Sarah, what an amazing story. And I mean, Dr. Urnov, what would you like to say?
Sarah, I just want to say to you, bravo. Congratulations. I salute you for your courage. And I think that reproductive autonomy of decision making is absolutely one of the central things that we as a society have to maintain, Sarah. So I really, you know, please accept a work appropriate hug remotely for your courage. I also want to say to you that this is why when we use CRISPR on children or adults, we only do that for very severe disease for which the standard of care is really terrible. For example, earlier today, a group of physicians from UCSF and yours truly were in a call with the Food and Drug Administration discussing an experimental CRISPR therapy for an immune disease of children where kids present with a mild infection, and they can die within 2 months, right? So there is no discussion. The doctors said to the FDA, look it, we have no options. It is appropriate to use CRISPR here. Separately, if you think back to the story of Kyle Jr., the child from Philadelphia, his treating physician said, look, his only other option is a liver transplant. It's going to be just a lifetime of suffering. So I really commend you for your courage in taking a stand and want to emphasize that we developers of CRISPR medicines, for that reason, only propose to use it on existing humans with existing horrible disease where the standard of care is really terrible.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in Sarah's case, Dr. Urnov, I mean, it turns out that the screening was wrong. And I guess a question here is, I mean, how accurate are these screening tests?
My goodness, the technical term for that is, quote, false positive, which sounds boring, and it is the bane of all of our existence. I think that in certain cases, like very specific diseases, and there's a good number of them, our confidence in the test is pretty high. Unfortunately, again, I don't want to be the technologist saying we have all the solutions. We don't. Sometimes you have a test, and the genetics return something called a VUS. The VUS stands for variant of uncertain significance. And then at that point, there begins this, you know, gray zone of do we know versus not know. And I go back to Sarah's choice. I get so moving. It gave me goosebumps listening to you speak. This is ultimately, and to Katie and all the ethical issues, we have to give parents the opportunity to be in control of their reproductive choices. And we have to be transparent with them about what our tests do show and don't show.
Hmm. Well, let's go back to the phones. Matt in Fremont, welcome to Forum.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have been working in genetics since 2000 when I graduated from college. And we loved Gattaca. And I've talked about it every company I've worked at. And the consensus, at least from the people that I know working on this is that it's not an if, it's a when. It's not a decision that is going to be made in an ivory tower, as was mentioned earlier, because that will just push it into other countries where it's allowed. It's going to happen. It's going to be, how do we manage it, and how do we make the counseling and the process something that people can make good moral decisions on, rather than considering it to be unethical. The ethics are kind of gone. It's going to happen. It needs to be a moral question where individual choices are made.
Yeah. Well, thanks for that perspective, Matt. And I mean, Catherine, I want to take that to you. I mean, what do we know about the guidelines or any sort of regulations around this kind of technology? Does anything exist to date?
Sure. So embryo editing itself happens all the time in the United States for research purposes. But once embryo editing moves into editing an embryo with the intention of creating a child, that's where the FDA steps in. And that the FDA is not allowed even to review an application for that clinical trial, which effectively means it's banned in the United States. Now, not every country is the same. Some countries have different policies on this, and that's sort of at the root of preventive's regulatory arbitrage that they are exploring in trying to maybe conduct some of this work outside the U.S.
You know, Catherine, one thing that I think, you know, maybe gives people the heebie-jeebies is a little bit is like the Silicon Valley Titan aspect of it. And one thing I noticed in your reporting is how many of these founders of gene editing startups or gene screening, they're graduates of the Peter Thiel Fellowship. And I wondered if there's a connection there, and maybe you can, did that strike you as you were doing this reporting?
Yeah, that certainly did strike me as I was doing this reporting. As you know, the founders of Nucleus and Orchid are both Thiel Fellows. Those are polygenic screening companies. What I would say, and drawing on what some of the callers who have very courageously shared their personal stories about pregnancy and child rearing with us, I think that points to, you know, something that we all know, which is how deeply intimate pregnancy and child rearing is. And I think that in my reporting, some of the squeamishness that some people, not all, but some people express to me relates to, well, you know, do I want a cryptocurrency entrepreneur getting into this space? Do I want an artificial intelligence entrepreneur getting into this space? Is this something, you know, I'm looking at what their other companies are doing, and maybe I have some questions about that. And, you know, I don't know if I want them to be getting into the incredibly personal, intimate, vulnerable world of creating a child.
We have a couple of comments here. Christine writes, as a pediatrician who exclusively sees well newborns, I want to emphasize the importance of parents being ready to love the baby they have, even if the baby is not who they expected. The parents who seem to have the hardest time adapting to the baby they have are the ones who stated that they had a, quote, perfect pregnancy, and all the testing was, quote, normal. Parents who desperately want a baby and are ready to take a baby despite potential flaws seem to adjust best. And Sue writes, detecting and designing the physical perfection of a human being does not foretell a perfect human being. The nurturing after birth and all through life creates the human. A person can be physically perfect at birth and yet develop into a troubled and dysfunctional human. So true. Let's go back to the phones. Marcus from San Francisco, welcome to Forum.
Yeah, I was going to make the same comment that CRISPR, my son has a rare hereditary genetic condition, same thing as other callers have mentioned, and that something like CRISPR could just undo it. But I guess to that point of designing the perfect physical human doesn't necessarily make a perfect human. Like to that point of I love him regardless that he has this, and regardless that my wife also has this genetic condition and gave it to him in some way. But I guess maybe she has, maybe my wife struggles with that guilt of it. Like she has this dominant hereditary condition that she passed on. And with something like CRISPR, she could just not do that. I'm just maybe curious about that aspect of it.
Yeah, I mean, and Dr. Ernov, you've mentioned this before, but when it comes to finding cures for children or adults with gene-related diseases, you look for the most dire cases, right?
The golden rule in my field is we don't build therapies for patients, we build therapies with patients. None of us is under the delusion that here we are at Berkeley building the perfect CRISPR and suddenly everybody will be gleefully accepting of them. And again, the story of this cohort moves me very deeply. I have spoken with many parents who have children living with genetic diseases, and they're unanimous in the profundity of the deep love for that human being. Precisely as you said, at this stage in the development of CRISPR gene editing, we are passionately advocating to confine it exclusively to settings where there is not a good clinical option and where the suffering is very profound. Until we've established a longer track record of efficacy and safety in these absolutely, this is either CRISPR or terrible things will happen. I don't think that we should be having any serious conversation about expanding it to wider patient populations, to say nothing, heaven forbid, baby improvement.
I mean, from an ethical point of view, Katie, what do you think we need to be developing in terms of guidelines? You know, if, as our caller said, this is not a if this is going to happen, this is a when this happens.
I would first want to just push back a little bit on that idea of inevitability. I mean, I think there are still choices that we can make, and there are still choices that we have made, right? Coming back to the issues of laws and regulations that still exist. I was a co-author on a study where we actually looked at what is the legal landscape around both editing embryos in the lab and on the possibility of creating genetically modified children. And we found that 70 plus countries had regulations already on the books. This was in 2020 that prohibit heritable genome editing. And that is a really striking degree of agreement, right? There was no country that explicitly allowed heritable genome editing. So I think that line has been drawn in a lot of places. And, you know, if we don't want a technology like this and all of the risks that it poses to society and to individuals, you know, we can still make decisions about whether we allow it. And I think, you know, despite the fact that maybe these Silicon Valley titans think the rules shouldn't apply to them and what they want to do.
Well, with a minute we have left, I'm going to give you the last word, Dr. Ernov. I mean, a lot of money is being put into this designer baby industry. And yours is probably a research that could use some of that money. Do you think that the funding in one place is misguided? And we have just a minute.
My goodness, since I'm speaking on KQED, which is the home station of the San Francisco Bay Area, dear listeners, if any one of you has extra money to invest in healthcare, I really encourage you to look around. In the Bay Area right now, there are multiple for-profit companies, as well as elite institutions of biomedical research. UCSF, Stanford, UC Berkeley. I encourage you to donate that money to them so that they could put it to great use to treating and alleviating existing human suffering in existing children and adults, rather than any of these, how do I put this, forays into quasi-eugenics.
Yeah, well, and Catherine, you had a comment that I'm just going to read. This is from Catherine Long. I think that a lot of these deeply personal stories point to is how intimate pregnancy is, which is also at the root of some of the anxiety of the people that I spoke to and how they feel about tech elites getting into this space. So much more to say, and we'll end that here. We've been talking about efforts to create genetically engineered babies. We were joined by Dr. Fyodor Ernov, Katie Hassan, and Catherine Long. Thank you all for joining us this morning. Thanks so much to our listeners and callers for sharing your stories. And I'm Grace Wan, in today for Alexis Madrigal. Stay tuned for another hour of Forum Ahead with Mina Kim.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the Generosity Foundation and the members of KQED.
Coming up on KQED, the 10 o'clock hour of Forum, in just about a minute after we say good morning to Elaine Leung, she has details about a crash in Palo Alto.
Good morning, Dave. It was a crash that had been out there for quite some time. North 101 past San Antonio. Good news, it is completely gone. However, traffic's still fairly slow from Fair Oaks Avenue. Bay Bridge improvements, it's now slow from the 880 overcrossing. And BART is on time. This after earlier police activity at the Berkeley station this morning. Elaine Leung for KQED.
Traffic support comes from Rush Creek Lodge and Spa Yosemite. Support for KQED comes from PG&D, encouraging listeners to be prepared for emergencies by practicing opening their garage door manually and considering backup power options. More at safetyactioncenter.pge.com. I'm Dave Freeman. Good morning, and thanks for listening.